Hey, everybody. Good evening. Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. How you doing? You okay? Good. Martha Raddatz asked George Bush a question about al-Qaeda in Iraq, and you've probably heard the answer. And what's his name? The guy over on the other network, ABC, Jonathan Carl, asked Cheney about torture. And we'll play both these answers for you. Both of these schmucks, on their way out of town, you see, they admit to... In simple declarative sentences, and in Bush's case, that's usually one or two words, they admit to being war criminals. It's pretty unbelievable. I guess they do it because they know they'll never be prosecuted. Well, there may be a surprise for them. You never know. It may not come from the federal level. It may come as a result of Vince Bugliosi's book and prosecutegeorgebush.com website. If you haven't gone there, check it out. Full-page ad, page 815, New York Times this morning. I just about spit my coffee all over the kitchen floor. A picture of Blagojevich, and in, I don't know, what is that, about 42-point lettering, Blagojevich indictment, and then election law scandal. And then who's connected to both? The union leaders at SEIU, the Service Employees International Union. Is that what that is? Full-page ad in color. It says SEIU has given more cash to Radek Blagojevich than any other group in America. They also offered to help in his, quote, sale, end quote, of a U.S. Senate seat. Oh, did they really? What's your proof, you bastards? And SEIU has been a longtime financial partner of the often indicted Acorn. And it goes on. What this ad is all about, and it's from a neo-fascist organization. They have a website, unionfacts.com. Oh, yeah. Okay. What this is about is a full-scale attack, assault, on the remaining vestiges of union organization, union labor in this country. You remember Gettelfinger with the email that he had when he had a press conference last week where key Republican members of the Senate were talking about, now's the time to strike. This we can get a twofer here. We can stick a knife in the heart of the union movement, and we can also... operate for the foreign auto manufacturers. I mean, these sons of bitches are really going for the jugular. They really, really are. And what a time to try it when there is a Democratic president, House, and Senate. I'm not sure what the game plan is here, but if you have any how they're going to try to pull this off. But if you have any doubt whatsoever that there is a full-scale assault on organized labor in this country, and organized labor equals middle class, and middle class equals decent jobs, and decent jobs equals, well, you know, and the Republicans want to destroy it all. You know, I still can't get my mind around what is their motivation. Do these dumb bastards not understand that in destroying the middle class, they destroy America? If it's not already destroyed, which it, you know, there's a strong argument out there that it is. It's already we're like a fighter in 12 round championship fight who's been beat, had the hell beat out of him for 9 rounds. We're in the 10th and we're just staggering around the ring. But these Republicans, what is it that they want? Do they want serfdom to come back? Do they want to be lords and ladies? Jesus Christ, I'm telling you, you heard it here. They're going to push until finally the explosion that occurred in Greece is going to occur. The explosion that has occurred in so many societies when the people say, finally, you know, enough of this crap. Enough of this. We've had enough. But this attempt to murder the remaining breathing entities that represent the labor movement, organized labor in this country, I mean, these guys can't stand having organization on the other side of the fence. You know, the National Organization of Manufacturers over here and the Chamber of Commerce over here and all these phony-ass right-wing think tanks, I mean, organized down to the point where they can't, most of them can't even go to the bathroom without sending to a committee. But on the other side, you know, the middle class, the working class, organized labor. Oh, no, none of that. What do those sons of bitches want? They want decent pay. They want decent jobs. They want to send their kids to college. They want to go to school. Nah, screw that. Have I mentioned yet to know how much I hate these people? These scum. Oh, my, you did it again. I'm sorry. 5 minutes into the program. I see this ad. It's on page, you can go look at it yourself if you want to, page A15 if you get the times. I don't know if you can see it online. Oh, my God. And what they're trying to do here, the whole purpose is to stop, first of all, stop the union movement. They want to murder what's left of it. But the Employee Free Choice Act. And that would that's the bill in Congress that will give workers the right to organize. Very simply, it's like registering to vote. You go fill out a your voter registration card, right? When you first that's what the Employee Free Choice Act is about. It's similar to it. You just fill in a card that says, "Yeah, I want a union in my shop." Boom, that's the end of it. And then the National Labor Relations Board orders the employer to stand back and let the union rep come in. And this is driving the people behind this ad, the so-called unionfacts.com. Obviously, there are chambers of commerce, including the National Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, what's left of them, and all these right-wing business organizations. You know, when's the last time you heard of a union guy absconding with $50 billion? When's the last time you heard of a union equivalent of Enron? Oh, what about the Teamsters, Mike, back in the 70s? Oh, okay. You mean their big investment in Las Vegas? Well, you're absolutely right. You got me there. When have you heard of a union being bailed out to the tune of $700 billion. I mean, I could go on and to the point of ridiculousness, right? But organized labor, it's always been something that the right wing has hated. What they want is what they had in the from the beginning of this country. They want slavery. They want free labor. And in return for the free labor, they will give, a bowl of gruel. Since we're in modern times, you open an artery? Oh, okay, here's a Band-Aid. You want a place? Well, go live down at the quarters. What's the quarters? Oh, those are those shacks down there in the bottoms. What's the bottoms? That's where the swamp is. Oh, that's what these son of a bitches want. They want slavery. They want it. It'd be perfect. It was so wonderful in this country in the 1850s. And you know the funny part? The auto manufacturers have spent hundreds of millions, all right, tens of millions of dollars. They funneled into the Republican candidates' election and re-election coffers over the years. Just tens of millions of dollars. We'll talk about that in a second when we come back. I love it, though, because then the Republicans just turn right around and cut the throats of the very organizations, not the unions. Unions don't give these sons of bitches anything. But the auto companies, you know, the companies themselves. Here's a million, here's 5 million, here's 10, here's 15, 20, here's all the money. Just save us from those goddamn regulations. We can't have 30 miles a gallon. We can't have safety belts. We can't have blah, 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 on and on and on and on. All this money. And eventually the Republicans turn around and cut their throats. That's the nature of Republicans, isn't it? Of course it is. Of course it is. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Well, you better listen, my sisters and brothers. Because if you do, you can hear their voices still calling across the years. And they're all crying across the ocean. And they're crying.
No subliminal messages for you to misunderestimate. It's Mike Malloy. He's commonsensical.
So, the Republican senators, of course, they're known for this. All Republicans are swine. The ones who get elected are special swine because they have this uncanny ability to fool the dumbasses that vote for them. And they do it over and over again. But even better, just like the guy that ran the $50 billion Ponzi scheme on all the rich people, the Republican fundraisers have the uncanny ability to screw the corporate Americans who contribute so much money to them, right? So the Republican senators appear to have bitten the hand that fed them where it concerns the auto industry. For example, just over the last decade, General Motors has given $1.50 to Republican candidates for every dollar it gave to Democrats. That same pattern has been followed by Chrysler and Ford, which each year, year after year, after year after year, have favored the Republicans in Congress, sometimes by more than a 3-to-1 ratio in dollar terms. 3-to-1. 3-to-1. Since 1990, according to LA Times, since 1990, the auto industry as a whole, including suppliers, dealers, and manufacturers, has cut $100 million in checks to Republicans, $34 million to Democrats. was it Thursday night? The car makers discovered what loyalty means to Republicans in senators and what that investment strategy bought them. A kick right in the groin. But that's what Republicans do. They are filthy bastards. They will sell their own mothers. They will step over the bodies of their own sons and daughters if they see a $20 bill hanging in a window someplace. They are really scum. Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, said, quote, car makers have always leaned Republican, but it'll be interesting to see whether what happened last week changes that pattern, end quote. Oh, yeah, the Democrats, meanwhile, have always looked to the United Auto Workers for support. Since 2000, the union has given $12.5 million to Democrats. Oh, they gave little Republicans, too, $94,000. Oh, and I love this statement. A spokesman for General Motors, some brain-dead son of a bitch named Greg Martin. Here's a guy that really belongs in management. He says, quote, "It's highly doubtful that political giving ever played a factor in an individual member of Congress's position where it concerns voting."
Oh, Jesus, God.
Oh! And some of the loudest opponents to helping Detroit, of course, are senators we've talked about. These states are from our home to car factories of foreign brands, like Richard Shelby, who has Mercedes, Hyundai, and Honda plants in his state, but no Ford, Chrysler, or GM. Bob Corker in Tennessee has received $250,000 from the auto industry throughout his career, but Tennessee is also home to several Nissan plants and is the Japanese automaker's U.S. headquarters. Huh? So, of course, Bob Corker is going to turn right around, take out his little box cutter, and remove the descended testicles of the automakers. Why not? Why not? Why not? And, of course, that action alert circulated among Senate Republicans last Wednesday that called on their slimy brethren to, quote, stand firm and take our first shot against organized labor. And they really are. I mean, it is such a coordinated effort. The trouble with the car makers was an absolute gift. It was a gift from their twisted god directly to them. And then you heard today that the Toyota plant in Mississippi isn't going to open. I wonder why not. It's 90% completed. Did you hear that on the news? The owners of the plant have decided, We'll wait. Let's see what happens. Because you know why? Toyota, Honda, Nissan, they all want some money now. Why not? What about Muntahar al-Zaidi? Muntaha, how do you say his name, Kathy? You speak Arabic. Muntadhar al-Zaidi. He's a journalist. He was kidnapped by militants in Iraq last year. He was held for 3 or 4 days, and no ransom was paid. He was turned loose. Now he's being held by more terrorists, the Iraqi Security Organization, as of today. They're interrogating him about whether anybody paid him to throw his shoes at George W. Bush at the press conference on, was that Saturday? Did you see that? Of course you've seen it. You've seen the video. Thousands of Iraqis took to the streets today to demand his release. And Arabs across many parts of the Middle East hailed the journalist as a hero and praised his insult as a proper send-off to George W. Bush. Allah forgive me, but I happen to agree. I think it's great. Two shoes. I have to say, Bush is a pretty good ducker. I've always said that. Bush is a ducker. He really is a ducker. He ducked those shoes, didn't he? Did you see those shoes? He is just a shoe ducker. He's a shoe ducking son of a gun, isn't he? He ducked them shoes. Hey, George, you're a good ducker, boy. You are.
He left. He called out to me. I'm in the Guantanamo. I heard the girls are sweeter there. I'm in the Guantanamo. We'll have a water board to share.
Doing talk radio right. From the left, it's more of Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. So the guy who threw his shoes at Bush and called him, said, "This is a farewell kiss, you dog." He went on to scream, "This is from the widows, the orphans, and those who were killed in Iraq." He speaks the truth. As far as throwing the shoes, that's very insulting in Arabic, in Arabic culture, as you know by now. I had no earthly idea myself until I learned about it. It's a deep, hitting someone with a shoe is a deep insult in the Arab world, I guess, signifying that the person being struck is as low as the dirt underneath the sole of the shoe. And making it even worse, of course, or compounding the insult, let's put it that way, were Zaidi's words. This is the farewell kiss, you dog. Calling someone a dog is never polite among Arabs who traditionally consider dogs unclean. This murderous war criminal who invaded their country is responsible for the deaths of how many women and children and men, old and young. And the smug bastard goes over there and stands there with his would-be puppet, Maliki, whatever the hell his name is. Oh, my God. Now, there's a couple things here that are real clear. And that is, you know, supposing instead of a shoe, it would have been a hand grenade. Where was the security? Of course, I mean, what are you going to do? Make people take off their shoes before they come into a little gathering like that with Bush. Bush is there to rub these people's faces in it. It's a wonder that only one of them had the courage to take off his shoes and throw him a Bush. Bush is a pretty good ducker, though, isn't he? According to Associated Press, the incident raised fears of a security lapse in the heavily guarded green zone where the press conference took place. The response to the incident in the so-called Arab street was, I don't know if ecstatic would be the right word, but it was certainly over the top. Al-Zaidi is being called a hero 42-year-old Jordanian businessman quoted here said al-Zaidi is the man. He did what Arab leaders failed to do. In Baghdad's Shiite slum of Sadr City, thousands of supporters of radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr burned American flags and called for the release of al-Zaidi because he's being tortured now. He's being held by our puppets there. His shoes were being held as evidence. Oh, God. The protesters who hit the streets in Sadr City chanted in unison, quote, Bush, Bush, listen well, two shoes on your head. Okay, it doesn't rhyme, but, you don't know how it sounds in Arabic, right? In Najaf, a Shiite holy city, some protesters threw their shoes at American patrol as it passed. The American troops didn't respond. An incident like this that we here in the West just look at like, oh, what's that? Throw the shoes at him. Oh, son of a bitch. Well, that's like getting a pie in the face. No, it isn't. Not at all. Now, the incident, of course, is a big embarrassment for al-Maliki, who, get this, a statement released today, he called the prime minister, Maliki, said the shoe-throwing was, quote, a shameful, savage act, end quote. A shameful, savage act? Throwing a shoe at somebody? Son of a bitch. What do you call using white phosphorus on a civilian population in Fallujah? What would that be? Would that be, if throwing a shoe at somebody is a shameful, savage act, there are no words in English. Maybe there are in Arabic to explain using bombs comprised of white phosphorus on a civilian population in a town in Iraq. What would that be called? What would that be called, Kathy? If throwing a shoe at somebody is a shameful, savage act. Jesus, God. Al-Maliki is demanding a public apology from the news organization, Baghdad. It's a television station, independent Iraqi television station, Al-Baghdadiyah. Look for that one to be closed down fairly quickly. Opponents, this is from the New York Times, opponents of the continued American presence in Iraq turned Mr. Zaidi's detention into a rallying cry. Support for the detained journalists crossed religious, ethnic, and class lines in Iraq, vaulting him to near folk hero status. A 45-year-old teacher from Mosul, northern city that is contested by all three groups, Arabs, Kurds, and Turkmens, said, quote, I swear by God that all Iraqis with their different nationalities are glad about this act, end quote. Oh, man. He is truly Bush. It has to be the most despised Westerner on earth right now. I mean, even his fellow Westerners in Northern Europe and in other English-speaking countries, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, look at him as not an ally of any sort, but as someone who has brought shame and contempt and fear and disgust and chaos on the whole goddamn planet. It's incredible. And then there's this. Witnesses said that Mr. Zaidi, the shoe thrower, had been severely beaten by security officers Sunday after being tackled at the press conference and dragged out. One of his brothers said today that the family had not heard from Zaidi since his arrest, and that a security officer who picked up Mr. Zaidi's cell phone at midnight on Sunday had threatened the family. Miserable son of a bitch. Now, Bush. Now, here might be one of the reasons. I want you to hear this little bit of sound. Bush talking with Martha Raddatz, ABC's Martha Raddatz, another one of these filthy exit interviews where a desperate attempt. And I really like Martha Raddatz. There are very few. I don't mean I know her. I like her style. I like the way she sometimes can get around the bullcrap that her bosses tell her to put out there for American consumption. Every once in a while, Martha Raddatz zings right past the bullcrap artists who edit the videotape or edit the copy, and she gets in some pretty good points. And Martha Raddatz has that ability, as some journalists do, to completely color a statement by that putting that little line between her eyes by just a little bit of a frown or an expression on her face. I really like Martha Raddatz. That's what you have to do these days. If you're going to be a journalist with integrity in television, in television, you have to be able to Martha Raddatz the interview. Yesterday, after that incident in Iraq, and the Bush bastard gets back here, or was it? No, it was in Iraq before they left. Bush sat down with Martha Raddatz. Raddatz asked Bush about his legacy, and Bush at first he boasted about 52 months of uninterrupted job growth. 52. I mean, Jesus God. But this is what I want you to hear. Go ahead and roll. This is the little snippet from the Martha Raddatz interview of the war criminal George Bush. Let me see. Oh, there's a question that I need to. Oh, here it is. Martha Raddatz said, "Let's talk about this trip. Your last trip to this region as president. Your last trip to Iraq. Surely your legacy will be largely about this war. Talk to me, Mr. President, about how that feels being here. The last trip, and what you really think that legacy will be."
Clearly, one of the most important parts of my job, because of 9/11, was to defend the security of the American people. There have been no attacks since I've been the president, since 9/11. One of the major theaters against Al-Qaeda turns out to have been Iraq. This is where Al-Qaeda said they're going to take their stand. This is where Al-Qaeda was hoping to take...
But not until after the U.S. invaded.
Yeah, that's right.
So
what? I mean, the point is that Al-Qaeda said they're going to take a stand. Well, first of all, in the post-11 environment, Saddam Hussein posed a threat. And then, upon removal, Al-Qaeda decides to take a stand.
Oh, my God.
And they're becoming defeated. And I think history will say that, one, the world was better off without Saddam. Two, along with the Iraqi troops, we have denied Al-Qaeda a safe haven because a young democracy is beginning to grow, which will be an important sign for people in the Middle East.
Shut up. Oh, my God. No Al-Qaeda in Iraq until after the U.S. invaded. Yeah, that's right. So what? So what? This is the cavalier attitude. I just wish that the parents and the spouses and the children who have watched their sons and daughters or husbands or wives or moms or dads go into Bush's murder machine, I wonder what they think if they hear this. So what? Yeah, so what? Yeah, there was no war. There was no nothing until I decided to make a war and make people die. And boy, Martha, I've made a lot of them die. I've made a lot of Iraqis die. I've made a lot of Americans die. So what?
You measure your peace with guns. Your progress is in megatons. Well, who's left when the war is won? A soldier of a misfortune. A soldier of an angry call. Soldiers on foreign soil.
Got the flying monkey right blue? Here's the cure, Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour, so both Bush and Cheney are out here just lying their asses off. The desperate effort being made here to control the future, because that's the only way these pigs are going to be judged. There's nobody other than Muntadhar al-Zaidi who has the courage to stand up to Bush and just say, you know, a curse on your head, you son of a bitch. John New York City says, imagine a person so outraged by Bush's criminality that he'd risk his life to insult this principal villain of the 21st century, right to his smug, ugly face. How many of us would be brave enough to do that? No matter what happens to al-Zaidi, his recent actions come from a high moral place unknown to President Chucklenuts. And Pop Lewis says Mike Bush is impervious to any insult. He's a psychopathic narcissist clinically. He is incapable of feeling the pain of others and always sees himself in the right. Is it any wonder that he stood there grinning with that dodgeball look on his face? Yeah, miss, throw another one. And then Carl in San Francisco writes, Mike, Fox News had the nerve today to say that the shoe-throwing incident is indicative of how the Iraqis are ungrateful. The putz that is on in the afternoon said that this was a display of a lack of gratitude to the person who liberated Iraq. Well, gee, then I wonder why they hate us. Dick Cheney sat down with ABC News' Jonathan Carl. And Carl asked whether he approved the interrogation tactics used against so-called high-value prisoners. Cheney said he supported it. Listen to this. All right, we'll have it for you in a second. Where's Cheney? Is Cheney right there?
Did you authorize the tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
I was aware of the program, certainly, and involved in helping get the process cleared. That is, the agency, in effect, came in and wanted to know what they could and couldn't do.
He wants credit. He wants credit.
They talked to me as well as others to explain what they wanted to do, and I supported it. There was a period of time there, 3 or 4 years ago, when about half of everything we knew about al-Qaeda came from that one source. So it's been a remarkably successful effort. I think the results speak for themselves.
In hindsight, do you think any of those tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others went too far?
I don't.
And on KSM, one of those tactics, of course, widely reported was waterboarding, and that seems to be a tactic we no longer use. Even that, you think, was appropriate?
I do.
What do you say to those that say you've changed?
Well, the way I think of it, in terms of whether or not I changed, I think a prime.
All right, stop it there. Just stop it right there. Jonathan Carl makes me want to throw up blood. This little wimp sitting there.
Oh, some people say you've changed.
So you authorize the torture? Yeah. Some people say you've changed. All right, go ahead. Play the rest.
It was 9/11. And have I changed? Well, not in the sense that I've gone through some, fundamental psychological transition here. But I have been, since that day, focused very much upon what we needed to do to defend the nation. And I think
bastard.
The policies we've recommended, the programs
bastard.
That we've undertaken, have been good programs. I think those have been sound decisions. And if that's what they mean by saying I changed, I'm guilty.
Yeah, you're guilty, you son of a bitch. And little Jonathan Carl sitting there with these... I mean, he doesn't even have the guts to stand up to this old man that has all kinds of rods in his heart and just say to him, you know, as we sit here, Mr. Vice President, it's all I can do to stop my gag reflex. You lying son of a bitch. Give me some credit, is what Cheney's saying. I was up there with the big boys. I made the decision to torture these sons of bitches. Are you kidding? But the perfect opening for Jonathan Carl to say, but Mr. Vice President, you and your puppet have been saying for years that it was a few rotten apples in the barrel, that all this was done without authorization, that it must have been that PFC, Lindy England, or her psychopathic boyfriend who did all this, or some crazed son of a bitch down in Guantanamo. You mean it was you all along, Mr. Liar? So Cheney, now that he knows he's going to escape charges of being a war criminal, he knows. The word is already out. Unless he travels to a country where they decide to take the... I'll guarantee he'll never go to a Middle Eastern country. But now that Cheney and Bush understand what they've always known, we can get away with this. We can get away with this for a couple of reasons. First of all, the American public doesn't give a goddamn. The American public doesn't care. We can torture until blood runs out of our noses. American public doesn't care. They won't do anything. They'll sit on their asses. They'll go shopping like we told them to go after we set up the attack on this country. The American public doesn't care. They really don't. The Democrats in Congress.
Give me a break.
George Bush or Dick Cheney could, they could do anything. And there's not a Democrat with the exception, all right, one or two. Kucinich, maybe a couple other ones. But the ones in power will do nothing to disturb this little balance of power between the Democrats and Republicans, nothing. So now that they're ready to leave and, go make their big money and continue their theft, continue to pervert this country, and they know they're going to escape any kind of prosecution. They can just sit there in front of Martha Raddatz and Jonathan Carl and just give America and Iraq and the world the finger over and over and over again. Yeah. So what? Welcome back. Malloy program here on the Nova M Radio Network, being carried by all sorts of non-Nova M organizations. Everybody from XM to Sirius to the Internet to Clear Channel to CBS to... That's a good thing. That's a good thing. A lot of people get confused. What does he mean, Nova M Radio Network? That's where the show originates and where it's owned. Ron Gettelfinger said last week when he had his moment, and he will have more in the national spotlight. This is before the Blagojevich thing sucked up all the oxygen on Earth. Gettelfinger said that U.S. automobile companies are being put at a disadvantage by government, our government, in competing with Volkswagen's new auto assembly plant in Chattanooga, for example. Gettelfinger questioned why U.S. government leaders or state government leaders in Tennessee are willing to provide assistance. I'm sorry. U.S. government and state government leaders in Tennessee are willing to provide assistance to the to Volkswagen. That's a German company. While that state's senators declined to back a federal loan to help the big three U.S. car makers. Yeah, you know, Bob Corker, Tennessee. Gettelfinger said that trying to equalize UAW pay with what foreign car makers pay in the U.S. as urged by Corker is like comparing apples to oranges. In its home country, you see, Germany provides government-paid health care for Volkswagen workers, and VW is receiving $500 million in tax breaks and direct assistance from Tennessee governments to build this auto plant in Chattanooga. Gettelfinger said, quote, they use taxpayer dollars to subsidize our competition. It doesn't help our industry, end quote. Yeah, but Ron, see, the cars have nothing to do with any of this. Nobody's figured that out yet. The cars have nothing to do with this. Car mileage, car design, SUVs, pickup trucks, Priuses, hybrids. No. This is nothing about that. You heard the memo. We've all heard the memo. This is an opportunity to do two things. Screw the Obama administration before it even takes office and put a dagger in the heart of what's left of the union movement in this country. It has nothing to do with cars. It has nothing to do with gas prices or transmissions or windshield wipers. It's an act of murder. And that's all it is. Did you hear about the McCain's crew put up 10 BlackBerry smartphones for sale? And these BlackBerries from the McCain-Palin organization contained just a whole bunch of confidential campaign information, including phone numbers, emails, and other information. And according to the reporters who bought one of these, the campaign was selling off these devices at bargain prices at its headquarters, all kinds of stuff, office inventory, including phones, computers, other equipment. And among the hot items, $20. For $20, you buy a BlackBerry smartphone with dead batteries and no chargers included. So the reporters bought a couple. And one of the reporters said, when we charged them up in the newsroom, we found one of the $20 BlackBerry phones contained more than 50 phone numbers for people connected with the McCain-Palin campaign, as well as hundreds of emails from early September until a few days after election night. It goes on and on. Now, this would be all over the place. Everything would be exposed, except the two reporters are from a Fox affiliate in wherever. This is Fox 5 News, so I guess it's I guess it's someplace in Northern Virginia or where, in D.C. Many of the numbers the campaign failed to wipe or permanently delete from the devices were private cell phone numbers for campaign leaders, politicians, lobbyists. Lobbyists? Hundreds of lobbyists! But wait a second, I thought McCain... Oh, never mind. Failing to remove information from a device before selling it could result in a serious breach of security. Well, no kidding. Of course, what does McCain know? McCain doesn't know how to turn on a computer, much less what a BlackBerry really does. Jesus. One owner of the phones, when the reporters called, one owner said, oh, somebody made a mistake. All this stuff was supposed to be erased. They should have wiped this stuff out. And then this campaign staffer, former campaign staffer, added, given the way the campaign was run, this is not a surprise. I wonder if they have any links to any websites that have nude photos of Sarah Palin. Huh? Any of you ever heard of Noriel Roubini? He's called Dr. Doom. He's an NYU economics professor. And this was reported on CNNmoney.com last week. I did get a chance to share this with you. but this is kind of scary. You want to hear something scary? The Dow down to 4,000, food shortages, a bubble in treasury notes. Fortune magazine spoke to 8 of the market's sharpest thinkers, and what they had to say about the future is frightening. Dr. Doom said, quote, we are in the middle of a very severe recession that's going to continue through all of 2009, the worst U.S. recession in the past 50 years. It's the bursting of a huge leveraged up credit bubble. There's no going back and there's no bottom to it. It was excessive in everything from subprime to prime, from credit cards to student loans, from corporate bonds to municipal bonds. You name it, and it's all reversing itself right now in a very, very massive way. At this point, it's not just a U.S. recession. All of the advanced economies are at the beginning of a hard landing, Mr. Roubini says, and emerging markets, beginning with China, are in severe slowdown, so we're having a global recession, and it's becoming worse. Things are going to be awful for everyday people, he says. U.S. gross domestic product growth is going to be negative through the end of 2009, and the recovery in 2010 and 2011, if there is one, is going to be so weak that it's going to feel like a recession. He says, I see the unemployment rate peaking at around 9% by 2010. The value of homes has already fallen 25%. In my view, home prices are going to fall by another 15% before bottoming out in 2010. And then he says this, for the next 12 months, I would stay away from risky assets. I would stay away from the stock market. I would stay away from commodities. I would stay away from credit, both high yield and high grade. I would stay in cash or cash-like instruments such as short-term or longer-term government bonds. It's better to stay in things with low returns rather than lose 50% of your wealth. You should preserve your capital. It'll be hard and challenging enough. I wish I could be more cheerful, but I was right a year ago, and I think I'll be right this year, too. Oh. Well, I'm going to keep, what do we got, Kathy, about $1,600, $1,800 put back? Just, I'm thinking about taking it out of the, even my blessed credit union, putting it in a sock and keeping it around the house here. All right, there's one more, some more trends forecaster Gerald Celente. I got this from prisonplanet.com, Paul Joseph Watson's website. Gerald Celente is saying that America is going to see riots similar to those currently going on in Greece, and that the cause will be hyperinflationary depression leading to the inevitable use of troops and mercenaries to deal with the crisis that Americans are incarcerated in internment camps. Jesus God. Merry Christmas. All right, a little bit more from Celente, or is it Celente? C-E-L-E-N-T-E. Anyway, a little bit more from this person, and then we'll take some phone calls. All right? 800-989-1480 is the number, so hold on to your seatbelt. He has been told to say it clear, to say it cool. It's over. It ain't going any further. You feel the devil's riding crop. Get ready for the future. It is murder.
Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's more of Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. So back to this guy, Gerald Celente. He apparently his track record for predictions is fairly accurate. He predicted the 1987 crash, the subprime mortgage crisis, in the so-called panic of 2008. He's routinely cited by mainstream networks as highly credible. Celente told interviewer Lou Rockwell, I'm sure you've been to his website before, libertarian kind of guy who writes the antiwar.com, the cause of the riots would be a hyperinflationary depression. Causing Americans to revolt in similar circumstances that we've seen recently in Iceland and still ongoing in Greece. Celente says the trouble would be sparked off by Obama declaring a bank holiday whereby people won't be able to withdraw their money. You think so? Celente reiterated his prediction of a revolution and riots in America and said that the first signs of it could even emerge before the end of the year. Celente said that the troops that were brought back to America for so-called domestic security would be used to suppress the riots. He went on to say, quote, there's talk of opening all these detention centers and hiring the goon squads, the Blackwaters, to run them, so there are realities going on as we speak, end quote. He added that the Halliburton subsidiary KBR, Kellogg Brown Root, had been awarded a $500 million contract to build national emergency internment camps. Yeah, that was a couple of years ago, wasn't it? In the name of detaining illegal immigrants, but that they'll be used to hold rioting Americans instead. Salenti said, quote, "We're really in a period of off with their heads, and it's going to be the people against the politicians." Salenti said that a breakup of the United States was possible and that the secessionist movement was strong. Jesus, God. There's more here. That's enough. I can't do it. No, I can't do any more. And we're all going to be turned to cannibalism, too, I guess, right? Because there won't be any food. I don't know. The Russians are coming. Are you aware of this? Russia said today it is sending a group of warships to Cuba. That's the latest move around so-called U.S. territorial waters, part of a drive to revive Cold War ties with Latin America. That's how it's being reported, Cold War ties. The warships will visit Havana on December 19th through the 23rd, the Navy said, Russian Navy, continuing a tour that has already taken the Russian military to Venezuela and Nicaragua. And we've already had ships, Russian ships, pass through the Panama Canal for the first time since World War II. I haven't seen that reported by Charlie Gibson. Have you? The Russian naval headquarters said in a statement, quote, "This will be first visit to Cuba by Russian warships since the Soviet era." They don't talk that way. I'm just pretending. They're sending a destroyer, the Admiral Chabanenko, and two other ships. Have already held exercises with Venezuela's Navy and Navy in the Caribbean. Well, you know, I mean, if we're going to ring their country with, you know, in Poland and the Czech Republic and other places with so-called missile defense systems, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, then the Russians are going to come back and say, go ahead, send these things. We will send ours. And last month, remember this, the Russian figurehead President Dmitry Medvedev made a tour of Latin America. He visited Cuba and Venezuela and met Castro. Part of efforts to revive what he called, quote, privileged relations, end quote, with Cuba. And he also had a visit last week from Argentinian President Cristina Kirchner, another Latin American critic of the United States. Oh, God. Huh? Isn't Bush done a great job? Huh? Of course, that's not Bush. I mean, that's a result of 125 years of murderous U.S. policy against our southern neighbors, especially Cuba. But I don't know. Bush kind of revels in it, the son of a bitch. You know, I think the rest of the presidents who have maintained this insane policy against Cuba for the past half century kind of, you know, didn't like it, but since they were being controlled by their corporate masters, there's not a whole lot they could do about it, and they couldn't lose that Cuban vote in South Florida, you know. But I think Bush relishes it. He loves it, huh? Como se llama? Me llamo Killer. Me llamo Killer. They tried to kill me with the shoes today. No, that was Saturday, Sabado. I am El Presidente Jorge Augusto. Como se llama? Cuando años? I speak español very good because I am El Presidente Jorge Augusto, whatever. All right, some phone calls when we come back. Are you on hold? Is anybody there? Let me see that screen. Oh, my goodness. All right, we have one open line. Come on, get in here. 800-989-1480.
You don't know how lucky you are, boy. Ragtime Lullaby. It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour. Okay, as promised, to your phone calls. Lewis is calling from Queens, New York, listening on the internet. Lewis, welcome to the program.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, you are?
Lewis from Queens, New York.
Really?
Yeah.
How you doing?
All right. I just wanted to comment briefly on the shoe-throwing incident.
Yeah.
Hey, I just wanted to say that this incompetent dog, Bush, he got off so easy considering the fact that he endorsed and he pushed this warmonger that's been a complete, absolute disaster in Iraq in terms of being responsible for displacing millions of Iraqi families, mm-hmm. causing about a million deaths, including men, women, children, and elderly, destroying the infrastructure of that country, you know, having no water, no electricity, no security. And finally, this guy, Al-Zaidi, you know, threw this shoe with absolute proficiency, which is quite remarkable. And I think that's the closest they could come to any sort of vindication at getting back at Bush.
You know, a lot of people are making a joke about it, or they're saying, you know, smart-ass things about it. But can you imagine, I mean, you and I can only imagine, the absolute frustration and rage. How do you express the rage against a force that comes into your country, kills everybody and everything? Yeah, that's right. They got rid of the dictator. Okay. Kills everybody and everything. Destroys your infrastructure. Destroys tens of thousands of years of antiquities. Takes your oil, sets up agreements that says, well, our soldiers, when they commit crimes against you, they can't be prosecuted. A shoe? I mean, what would you do if this was going on in your country, Lewis? What would you do? And if the dictator of the country occupying your country was standing there in front of you, what would you do? I don't know what I would do. I would go nuts.
Quite frankly, I don't know what I would do, but there would certainly be a lot of rage. But what's also quite fascinating is that Bush seems astonished that people don't are not satisfied with what he's done with their country. He actually thinks that he was going to get a standing ovation over there on his last trip to Iraq. I mean, what's really is this guy going insane or?
Well, he's I don't think there's any argument any longer. Bush is a sociopath and no, seriously. I mean, clinically speaking, he's incapable of realizing the pain he causes other people. It's amusement for him. He can play pretend that he's upset about stuff, but that's only because, you know, someone has said to him, now you got to act a little bit upset about this. He is incapable. It's horrifying. And he doesn't understand, like you say, he doesn't understand why somebody would be so pissed off as to throw shoes, which, aside from the fact that had it hit Bush, it could, you know, could have cut his face or something. But aside from that, it's a heavy-duty insult in the Arabic-speaking world to do that. And Bush is a jerk. He has no idea. In addition to being a jerk, he's a criminal. He's a sociopath. Lewis, thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. God, the frustration from that guy. And I'm sure when he took off his shoes and he's waiting for the opportune moment to throw them, he's got to be thinking to himself, they're going to take me out of here in handcuffs. They're going to beat me. They may kill me. This is, after all, Iraq, a completely lawless country run by clans and militias and informants and bombers and government thieves, liars, U.S. contractors who are just as dishonest as the day is long. So this guy knows the risk he's taking. He's not in there in a suicide vest. He's not armed, obviously. I'm sure all these people had to go through 3 or 4 metal detectors. But he knows what's going to happen to him. And apparently it's happening I just wonder why the Iraqi soldiers or security that grabbed him, why they would do that to him. They're like the Vichy French, aren't they? The Nazi collaborators. Why wouldn't they get the guy out? Maybe they did, although witnesses said he was bleeding. Why wouldn't the Iraqi security get him out and hide him? Or go have a smoke with him and say, way to go. You displayed some real courage there, brother. If they beat him up, if they torture him, if the Iraqis, if they, Maliki says he should go to prison for 7 years, I heard today. Assault with a shoe, for Christ's sake. If that's the case, then, there's no argument here. These are like the French collaborators when the Nazis came in World War II. I'm not picking on the French. I'm just saying, those are the ones we all know about, the Vichy. Devrin is calling from Seattle, listening on the Internet. Devrin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me again.
Sure.
My sentiments, I think, for a lot of people I talk to, those who, are crazy in the head or wishing that the guy would have hit him. But after further contemplation, I'm thinking, you're right. He had to take off his shoes, And he probably waited for Bush to kind of be looking in his direction. Otherwise, he probably could have hit Bush, And I'm not here on your show to wish any harm unto a president.
I understand.
Yeah, but I'm just here saying, and another quick sentiment. The things that let's focus on what the man said, since Bush is unable to understand the beef. The man said, this is for the widows and the orphans that you left, that you caused here in Iraq. Now, if you break that down in English, that doesn't mean only Iraqis. That means Americans, too, people in British and whoever else was killed over there. Because remember, we had a large amount of help there, and so they all backed up. And a lot of countries lost lives, not just America, not just Iraq, Iraq being the most. But this is just an appalling thing. And then to think that while this man is being beaten to probably an inch of his life and the screams are being heard, how are the people responding in there? I mean, that's like some chambers, some torture chambers or dungeons, Mike.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It hurts, man. It really hurts.
I hear you loud and clear. Bush is incapable of understanding why the people of Iraq may look at him as a murdering son of a bitch, and he sees himself as a liberator, as somebody that rode in on the white horse, and Bush's inability to understand reality. You have somebody like that in position of the president of the United States of America, with access to all the weaponry, all the stuff he has access to. Jesus, God, you're putting the entire solar system at risk. Thank God at least Barack Obama has, is an educated person, understands, I think, international relations, understands he's got to keep it to himself, because when he talks about sitting down and talking to people, the right wing just starts to slobber all over themselves about, you got to talk to him. Oh, God. All right, Devrin, thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. Don is calling from South Dakota, listening on Sirius. Hey, Don.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Pretty good altogether. Thank you for what you do. Regarding the shoe incident, I was a conscientious objector during the Vietnam thing. And
good for you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I see this. We used to have, as best we could do in South Dakota, we do like street theater, and I think this is a perfect time. I would like to start a small campaign. I would like everybody to mail a shoe to George W.
Yeah, that would be very appropriate.
I think it'd be kind of fun. I remember I mailed at that time I mailed a teddy bear to my girlfriend. I just put a tag around its neck and put the address on it, and it arrived. Just tape a file card to the bottom of the shoe and address it to Pennsylvania Avenue, whatever the zip code is,
mm-hmm.
And if a lot of people, you know, while it's in the news right now, we got about 37 days before this man leaves. Mm-hmm. It would be a pretty good goodbye, you little, you know, worthless mm-hmm. piece of scrub. Here's a shoe for you. I would like to start a small campaign.
That's a good idea, Don. And I'll tell you, I agree. I don't think this shoe incident is over yet. I just don't think it is. I think there's going to be, aside from the TV comics are going to have fun with it, I don't think it's over. I hope it isn't. I like your idea, man. I really do. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Well, there's one thing I know. I'm younger than you. Even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul.
And now, the man conservatives love to hate, it's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour, Michael in New Mexico writes, regarding the shoes, these days packages of that size with the shoes would probably go to the bomb squad and then get thrown out, referring to what Don suggested. Michael writes, however, I heard today that the Code Pink contingent in Washington, D.C. is going to work out messages to tie onto shoes, tie a pair of shoes together, and then throw them over the White House fence. Myself, I want to see a line of dump trucks full of shoes emptying their loads onto the sidewalk on the Lafayette Park side. Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. John in Los Angeles writes, regarding throwing shoes, after the shoes were thrown, Chucklenut said that he saw no problem with it because Iraq is a free country. Yeah, I saw that. It's just insane stuff. John goes on, what would happen to anyone in this country if they decided to throw anything at Chucklenuts? This is supposedly a free country, but I doubt he would be so kind and understanding. Would we ever see that person again? John in Los Angeles, yeah. When he made that statement about, well, yeah, you know, this is a free country, I understand why people throw shoes at me. Again, just an inane, asinine, complete non sequitur, has nothing to do with anything. This guy is so sociopathic as to render almost anything he says meaningless in the sense that you and I might understand it. Meaningless to him. I've never seen anything like this. Yeah, there's freedom here. That's why they throw their shoes at me. Yeah. My God. Marge is calling from Indiana. Hey, Marge, welcome to the program.
Well, good evening, sir.
How you doing?
Well, fair to partly cloudy.
Yeah, that's my line.
Yesterday it was started out at 50, and last night it was down a single digit. So would you please turn the damn heat up?
They were
bringing in the brass monkeys, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. You have all my sympathy.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
What's got me a little, I'm talking to myself today. This guy Madoff, whatever the hell his name is.
Oh, the guy that lost $50 billion of other people's money?
Yeah, not only in this country, but halfway around the world.
Oh, yeah.
And supposedly the SEC was supposed to have been running an investigation on him 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And they didn't find anything.
No, they gave him a clean bill of health. That's what they were instructed to do by the Bush crime family. Give everybody a pass.
Another brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Oh, absolutely. There's going to be more of this, Marge. You know, you and I have no earthly idea how deep the rot has settled into this country because of 8 years of Bush and no regulation. Everybody looking the other way, just a free ride. Steal what you can steal before the show is over.
And what really pisses me off is these same people are running every damn bit of money that they can off to Grand Cayman, Bermuda, the Bahamas, wherever the hell else, where it's tax-free and unaccountable. Meanwhile, the folks at General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler are going broke because those lousy, no-good United Auto Workers are collecting $78 an hour for to include their benefits and pensions for the, for themselves and the retirees.
Yeah.
Jesus, Mary Joseph.
Isn't it awful?
I want to scream, yell, break something. I don't know. It really ticks me off.
I know.
And then he says, well, you know, he's ducking a size 10. Give me a... it wasn't him. It was Cheney that said that they were going to greet him with flowers and candy when they freed Iraq. Wasn't that...
We're going to be seen as liberators. They're going to love us. Everything's going to be fine. The war will pay for itself.
What a bunch of psychos.
It'll be quick. The people will love us. The only people who are going to get hurt are
5 years is quick.
Yeah, I know.
What's slow with those guys?
It's just been horrifying. And the hell of it is, Marge, you and I are of a certain age. I just wonder if you and I will be alive, and I mean this, to see this damage repaired. I wonder if my adult children will be alive to see this damage repaired. I don't know. This may be one of those events where you simply, the destruction and damage was so great that you can't recover from it.
It's so widespread. I mean, they're here, they're there, they're in every damn department. Oh, I know what I wanted to tell you. Do you still read Harper's Magazine?
Oh, yeah, I've subscribed to it.
The January issue has got 3 pages of their Harper's Index.
Yeah. Oh, I haven't gotten my copy yet.
You got to read that. Okay. Oh, my God. Usually it's just one page.
Yeah, yeah.
In January, there's 3 pages.
Oh, no.
You know, get a ruler because it goes clear across the page and read that sucker. Lord have mercy.
No, I'm not to the point where I need rulers yet, Marge. That's you.
Oh, I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you for that.
Hey, listen, thanks for checking in. All right?
You behave yourself.
I'll do it. All right.
Turn up the heat, would you?
I'll do it, Marge. Thank you. Marge lives in the, what is essentially the Chicago suburbs, right? What's the weather up in the Chicago suburbs tonight? Minus 19 with a wind chill? Peter is calling from San Francisco, listening on the internet. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Yo.
Hey, yo, yo.
Let me pull you off speaker.
That'd be a good idea.
Yeah. Am I off speaker?
Are you, you're asking me?
Oh, you're still on speaker. I can hear it.
Who's on speaker? I'm doing a radio program. On second? I'll tell you what now, Peter. I'm going to have to put you on hold. Got to put you on hold because we're about to come up to a break. So we don't use speakers. We use magic. We use the airwaves and satellite uplinks and computer hookups and modems and stuff like that. But we don't use speakers, right? But you stay right there. And when we come back right after this break, Peter, we'll come back and... try to chat. Oh, and by the way, if we get to it tonight, you know, this. Everybody's wondering why Blagojevich doesn't just, you know, resign and go get ready to go to prison. Well, does discussion of the selling of a political office constitute crime if it hasn't reached the stage where, you know, any specific offers are given or received? Interesting question, isn't it? We'll be back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Welcome back. This is the Malloy Show on Nova M Radio. Thanks for hanging around. If you're just joining us, man, did you miss a great first 2 hours? Whoa! You can catch it on the podcast. Regarding the shoes, Jen writes one thing about the shoe event. Please don't get me wrong. I don't want to rain on anyone's parade. Goddess knows I loved the viral clip. It's about time Bush found out how people really felt about it. But one thing that really kind of freaks me out, perhaps worries me, is the lack of speed the Secret Service took to act. I mean, put the clip up and watch it. The guy throws the first shoe and bends down to pick up the second and throws it. Now, I've seen police officers dive over people to get an individual. How come the Secret Service acted so slowly? My tinfoil hat is going off a little bit. Was this a staged event? How is Bush, the Bush crime family going to use this to their advantage? Will we see an American copycat and the reason for Directive 51 to go into effect? Like I said, I don't mean to rain on anyone's parade, but I have to wonder about these things. Oh, by the way, I saw a breaking news blurb, I can't remember where, that the reporter is being tortured in an American-run jail. I hate to say it, but it's probably true. Jen. Yeah, I haven't seen that. I know he was arrested, and he's probably just catching pure hell. He reminds me of the guy who stood in front of the line of Chinese tanks that were moving on Tiananmen Square. Remember that iconic photograph of what the courage of an individual really can mean? That photo, that bit of video, and it's not just the photo, because you have to watch the video. You remember that. 89, I can't believe it was almost 20 years ago. Well, it was 20 years ago. Well, no, almost 20. The Chinese man in the white shirt and the dark pants, and he had two shopping bags, and he jumped out in front of that line of 7 or 8 Chinese tanks moving towards Tiananmen Square, and the tanks stopped, and the lead tank swung to the right, and the guy sidestepped over to the right, and the tank moved back to the center, and the guy moved back to the center, the tank moved to the left, the guy moves to the left. Remember that? Every time I see that, I just break up. Absolutely break up. I wonder what happened to him. I wonder what will happen to the shoe thrower. Seems to me I read something years ago about what happened to that man, that Chinese man with the shopping bags. Nicholas writes about sending shoes in the mail. Mike, if he received 10,000 shoes in the mail, he wouldn't get it. His daughters would have to explain it to him. Yeah. It's just bizarre. Andre writes, regarding shoes, you know, revolutions are started with simple things like that. I hear you. Back to your phone calls. So we have an open line here, 800-989-1480. Peter, let's see if we can get Peter now. All right, Peter, no speaker phones.
No, I figured it out.
Okay.
number one, I'm really honored to follow Marge.
Yeah, Marge is, we've known Marge, known her, I guess you would say, since what, Kathy? Since WLS days.
I mean, I've been listening since IE America days.
Yeah, she used to call in then, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember how, you know, she was always although strident, very on point.
You think Marge is strident?
A wee bit.
You think? That's because she's been listening to this program for way too long.
And number two, the bumper music.
Oh, yeah, okay.
The Pink Floyd. I mean, you're like the only person who listens to the orchestral Pink Floyd besides myself.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I don't know who else would listen to that.
I don't either. You know, you've got to have had a real...
You know the guy that arranges that stuff? Got a sex change operation?
He did?
And now he's a lady? David Palmer?
David Palmer? Went from male to female? Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And number three, I just have to say, you know, instead of hurling shoes...
Yeah.
Why not use my boot socks?
Your boot socks?
That would be like a biohazard.
Yeah.
Clear the room. You know, hey, not just duck.
When I was in San Francisco a week or so ago, did you come by?
No, I was working.
Oh, okay.
Because I was working for the wonderful AT&T.
Oh, okay.
Run by Texans.
The what?
The wonderful phone company run by the Texans.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
Well, we don't have a clue. They can't run a...
Wait. Where'd Peter go? Wait, well, there's Peter. What now, Peter? Go ahead.
I'm saying they can't run a phone company or a country, Texan.
Oh, well, yeah, I think that's been proven in spades. Peter, thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. A Marge fan. Let me see what else I got here on Marge. Subject line, Marge needs a radio show. She is so effing knowledgeable and such a character. Maybe just team up with her for an hour. What a kick that would be. I don't know. That'd probably be pretty scary. That'd probably be pretty scary. And Michael writes in regarding Blagojevich, I guess this is about what I said before the break. Given the way the RICO statutes are written, yes, a discussion among known associates about getting a quid pro quo for a political appointment would constitute conspiracy to receive bribes, even though they had not had a chance to act on those plans or discussions. And even if someone later disavowed that plan of action and refrained from participating, in theory, they could be prosecuted for being part of a conspiracy at a specific point in time. Well, the reason I brought it up, there's a guy here, Lawrence Velvel, who's dean of the Massachusetts School of Law in Andover, Mass. In his December 11th blog, wrote that there might be no sustainable legal case against Blagojevich if events had not gotten to the point where Blagojevich actually said, quote, "We will appoint you to the Senate in return for $1 million," or something to that effect. Velvel, the dean of the Massachusetts School of Law, writes, "Maybe Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney, can make a conspiracy to commit those crimes stick, but on the other hand, maybe even conspiracy charges will lose." Velvel goes on, "All or nearly all that Fitzgerald seems to have given us to date are quotations and paraphrases of Blagojevich and company planning to do what all or nearly all American politicians, crooks the lot of them, have been doing for scores of years." Velvel goes on, "They've caught Blagojevich discussing what should be received in return for a political favor. Here, the favor of appointment to the Senate." And he goes on to say that a trial could see a parade of defense witnesses testifying, quote, "What Blagojevich was caught doing is simply typical of how politics has been practiced in this country since the age of Andrew Jackson." Velvel continued, quote, "A trial, if there is one, thus has the potential to blow up the American political system, and it is impossible to see how the politicians can let a trial take place." Velvel said nothing in his remarks should be misunderstood as defense or liking for Blagojevich, whom he described as a very distasteful crook. A little bit more here, because this is interesting. Velvel said he wonders why, given the crookedness Blagojevich is accused of, has long been an everyday matter in American politics. Given that, why Fitzgerald brought the case? One possibility, Velvel concluded, might be self-aggrandizement. He recalled that Fitzgerald, at a press conference, made it appear he was after really big game when he went after Lewis Libby, for exposing Valerie Plame as a CIA agent. But the outcome was, quote, "The lion that roared belched forth only a mouse," end quote, and that the higher-ups in that affair, the president, vice president, and Karl Rove, were never prosecuted. So when Fitzgerald came on so strong, maybe it was because he wants to save his reputation. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
But they changed my mind to an endless tune when they took my only son from me. I know it's true, oh so true. because I saw it on TV. I know it's true, oh so true, 'cause I saw.
Life's too short to listen to Right Wing Radio. It's more of Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Lauren writes, blah, blah, blah. Also, she says, I was traveling this week within Canada. And again, just have to shake my head when those flying in the U.S. have to take off their shoes at security, while those of us going elsewhere are allowed to keep our shoes on. Are American shoes really that much more dangerous? Still haven't figured out why shampoo, bottled drinks, and skin lotion are dangerous and can't be taken with one on the plane. I hope these rules go away someday. Flying out and back to California or to San Francisco or wherever I go, I don't get it either. I guess we have to take off our shoes. I don't know. I don't know because of the shoe bomber, but he got on a plane in the UK, didn't he? I don't know. They have changed the rules now on the shampoo. What is it, Kathy? You can take 2 ounces or something? I don't know. If you have it in a bottle, which is in a plastic see-through carrying case inside your carry-on luggage, I don't know. It's insane. But the Department of Homeland Security, Transportation Security Administration, whatever the hell it's called, all of this stuff is just... I don't understand. Maybe it's maybe there's a reason. When I fly now, I try to guess who among my seatmates is the armed TSA agent who will jump to the defense of us hapless passengers if somebody starts going nuts. Back to your calls. Dave is calling from Chicago, listening on the Internet. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, what's happening, Mike? Did you ever watch a baseball game where after the pitcher throws, the umpire doesn't say anything because it's such a beautiful pitch? You know, it's obvious to everybody. Those were two beauties. Those were two strikes.
those were... I mean, yeah. that guy, and I don't know, you got to give Bush a little bit of credit for a guy his age to duck like that. I mean, Bush really, he really moved, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, here's why the Secret Service didn't care too much. Bush has got a big entourage of people, and those, I think it's like 60 dogs that Bush travels with. I'm not making a joke there.
Uh-huh.
And they're sniffing dogs, that group was sniffed, searched. They know that those guys didn't have any weapons or anything, so that's why I didn't jump into it. But I've got a really long story here. I'm going to try to put in a thimble for you. Remember Marlboro, Vermont, and Brattleboro, Vermont? They had arrest warrants for Bush and Cheney.
Right.
Well, there's some people out here in Newport, Oregon, also did the same thing. Now, early in the year, I tried to do that in the suburbs of Chicago, and the police threw me out. They were so pissed. There's such big righties.
Yeah.
Now, I went back recently, same place, my police station, and I did the same thing, and I told them, hey, look, things have changed. Are you guys getting laid off yet? Are you losing your, are you losing any money for programs and stuff like this? And the guy looked at me with eyes that said, this guy knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I made my case, and I'm getting a nibble over there. There's a town near me that is definitely laying off police. I'm starting to get bites is what I'm telling you. There is a radio show next Saturday. It's Russ Belville. He's an Air America guy. He's putting me on for the first 15 minutes, and I'm going to lay out my case.
I talked
before about this. And what I like to do is get as many radio shows as possible together. Mike, they're going to kill me for this. Bush, Cheney, I'm willing to take it. Let's go. I want to try to get as many people on board as possible. I'm telling you about it. I'm going to tell everybody else about it. I'm going to be sending emails, doing a whole thing.
All right, I'll tell you what. Dave, do this. Send me, send me an email. Lay out all the details and stuff, and maybe I'll put you on. Thanks, Dave, man. I appreciate you checking in. Patrick is calling from Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, how are you doing, Mike?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. Long-time fan. Listen to you all the time.
Bless your heart.
I've always been intrigued by your question about how come these SOBs always get away with such high crimes and misdemeanors and nothing ever seems to be done about it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a popular refrain of yours that you seem to ask?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I was as befuddled as you, and I recently was at one of America's finest public institutions taking a class, and our professor encouraged us to research this thing called the Myth of Peaceful Progress by Richard Rubenstein. Are you familiar with it?
I am not. I'll tell you what, too, Patrick, let me put you on hold for a second because we got to do a break here. When we come back, tell us what this is, Myth of Peaceful Progress. It's kind of self-explanatory already, right? It's the title of a treatise, a book, an essay, that progress doesn't come as a result of peaceful action. I'll come back to you, Patrick, as soon as we do the break. This is Nova M. I'm Mike Malloy. Stay with us, please.
And maybe he'll find his place in heaven, because he might just die. Losing hope is easy when your only friend is gone, and every time you look around, well, it all just seems to change. But hanging on is easy when you've got a friend to call, when nothing's making sense at all. You're not the only one.
Here's your nightly ammunition against right-wing rhetoric. Get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
All right, it's 25 before the hour. We're talking with Patrick in Portland, listening to KPOJ. All right, the Myth of Peaceful Progress, Patrick.
Hi there, Mike.
Hey, what's that about?
Okay, well, real brief. Essentially, Richard Rubenstein is his full name. Using examples going back to the sort of the period between the Revolution and the formulation of our Constitution, he draws upon examples like Shays' Rebellion and popular debtor farmer revolts, and then he moves up into the 20th century, when you had this struggle for civil rights.
Right.
And essentially what he's saying is that outgroups in America have had to use either the threat of violence or violence itself in order to get full economic, social, legal rights realized.
Or progress.
Well, the myth of the progress part is that the dominant groups and the elite and also the media advanced an idea that actually that we've done this, we've integrated all groups in a big melting pot peacefully. But when you actually examine the historical record, it seems to contradict that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there have been exceptions. I'm not trying to advance the myth of violent progress either.
Right.
During the Great Depression and Roosevelt, there were concessions given to farmers, too, without revolt. But the point is that sometimes the threat of violence is actually necessary, and that it's a myth that we make progress through peace all the time.
Well, I certainly don't disagree with that at all. That's the carrot and stick idea. That's the iron fist in the velvet glove idea. And, yeah, I think historic. Yeah, go ahead.
Getting to your point that you often ask, why do these elites and dominant groups get away with crimes? He goes on using the example. He wrote this in 1988, and he used the example of the transition between Ford and Nixon when Nixon was pardoned, and then he also used the example of Iran-Contra, and he said that, in fact, what these groups did was something violent, and it was kind of a coalition between business leaders and political leaders, and they both sort of used the system to excuse each other's criminal behavior,
right.
And it was, but it was portrayed as vindicating the system and peaceful transition. But when you actually examine their acts, they were criminal and often violent.
Well, apparently that's about to happen again.
Right, and the challenge for Mr. Obama is to break away from that and to give equal distribution of justice.
Mm-hmm.
If I might add one other thing,
sure.
I think, you know, we've had a long history of general strikes that have been unsuccessful, but we haven't had much of a coordinated effort at a consumption strike. And I was wondering if one would harness the power of progressive radio and civil disobedience if on January 20th, in sort of a rolling blackout, starting at about 9 o'clock on the East Coast, we all just did nothing for 1 hour in each time zone. No consumption, turn off all the power that you can without, of course, threatening your own existence through cold or deprivation.
Right, right.
We might send corporate America a message that never again will we, the consumers, support the sponsorship of these criminals.
Well, I think that's a good idea. You know what scares me about it, and thank you, Patrick, is it would be seen as... rolling a nationwide blackout would be seen by the power as a form of January 20th amusement. Because I think the power that now is deeply embedded in this country to the point where I can't see a time that will be pried out, and I'm talking about the corporate power that doesn't give a goddamn whether you live or die or whether I live or die, they know that, you know, at 9 o'clock Eastern time, there's an hour blackout, and then at 10 o'clock, all the switches go back on. So it becomes a form of amusement. The elites, and I hate that term, but I don't know what else to use, who actually run corporate/political America, are immune. I mean, they truly are immune from any type of action that I can think of, short of open rebellion, open revolution. I mean, if somebody has a better idea, you know, I've talked about sit down also. I've talked about the MLK or the Gandhian model of just everybody stop on a given time, given day. But I'm also enough of a... realist to realize that there's almost zero chance of that ever happening in this country. First of all, the country is too big, too unwieldy. There is no centralized movement in this country. And so many other countries who, granted, don't have the population glut that we do. But there are institutions within the countries that serve as the wire or are a unifying force. It used to be, maybe, in a different time in this country, where unions were that way, or where the Democratic Party was that way, I don't know what the institutions ever were in this country who had the ability to bring the country to a standstill. Even the civil rights movement, as successful as it was in focusing attention, only was able to focus attention here, and then there, and then over there, and then back here. And you understand what I'm saying? I don't think even during the civil rights movement was there ever a nationwide strike. Now, the argument be made, well, you know, Mike, you're talking about 11% of the population. I don't know. You know, these ideas are wonderful. I'd love to see them put into play, put into action. I don't know what else to do. Passive resistance is certainly the only way to go. You know, I use the R word a lot on this program, or make the suggestion that eventually, if the people are pushed far enough, I don't know what the limit is in our society, our culture, but in other societies, other cultures, there is a limit beyond which, if you push the population, there will be violence, a violent reaction. And the pushing doesn't have to be overt and out in the open. It can be like the situation in Greece, where the killing by the police of a 15, 16-year-old high school student has triggered, what are they, into the second week now, well into the second week, of just resistance. the Solidarity Movement in Poland. We don't have something like that in this country. Which is not to say that something like that couldn't be brought about, but it's going to take, and I think the elites understand this, is going to take a frontal assault on us by their bully boys in order for Americans to resist on the level that would be necessary, passive resistance. I'm not very much of an optimist about resistance because of the depth to which the elites are entrenched. I mean, they own everything. They own media. They own government. They own the military. They own the means of production. They the political system. They own it all. It's theirs. The only thing they don't own is the illusion that you and I are still free. They don't own that yet. The illusion that you and I are still free. So I don't know how to respond to this. It's going to take, you know, a much more calculating mind, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, than mine is, in order to come up with the plan on how to let the power know that we're reaching a breaking point, that we're reaching a point where we are not going to go along too much longer. You know, the first stage is usually passive resistance or a sit-down strike. And again, I go back to the Solidarity model in Poland under Lech Wałęsa. And the absolute success of that movement that began in the Gdańsk shipyard, for heaven's sake, interesting to think about it, though, right? Connie is calling from Washington, D.C., listening on XM. Hey, Connie.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about the media in particular. I also believe that they are, you know, bought and paid for.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard the news story about the Iraqi throwing the shoe at George Bush,
uh-huh,
I was like, well, where are the U.S. reporters? Why are they not, you know, outraged? They cover torture as if it's a regular news story,
mm-hmm,
and go right from weather to torture to sports. It's so disturbing,
yeah,
and it makes it, for me, it makes it so difficult for me to even listen to the mainstream news, because I just feel like it's completely Orwellian.
Let me put you on hold, because and I'll come back, Connie. I have to do a break here. That's kind of my complaint about Jonathan Carl talking with this murderous, vicious another psychopath, Dick Cheney. And Cheney skims over his reasons for, yeah, authorizing torture. Oh, yeah, uh-huh, sure. And Jonathan Carl just sits there, and you can just see him kind of, I don't know, the seat of his pants getting wet, because he's obviously peeing all over himself. He doesn't know what to do. He's sitting and facing evil, and says, well, how has being vice president changed you?
Swings at each other on talk show TV. Why don't you just go ahead and turn off the sun? Cause we'll never live long enough to undo everything they've done to you. Undo everything they've done.
Thanks to our crew, Ian Huff, who engineered, Ben Birch, who advises technically, Sharon Gordy, our military affairs correspondent, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, our ethical advisors, Bruce Enberg, economic advisor, and Catherine Bay, the executive producer. We were talking with Connie, who has called in from Washington. All right, where were we, Connie? Oh, about U.S. reporters,
you were talking
right?
About Dick Cheney.
Oh, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
You had mentioned the interview with Dick Cheney and the reporter just
Jonathan
not knowing
Carl,
what to say.
Yeah, it's a shame. And I think the reason we have witnessed this with the Bush administration is because we have reporters for the network television industry anyway, whose sole goal, objective, is to become a White House, get that White House press pass. And once they get it, it gives them entree into a little corner of a world that they otherwise would never get to. And they're terrified to do their job. As we pointed out many times on this program, and as you know, being a reporter is the only job that is mentioned in the Constitution is having constitutional protection, the First Amendment, a free press. And they have failed so miserably to watch American reporters question Dana Perino or the Defense Department spokesman or Cheney or Bush or any of these people is to witness cowardice. For the most part, there are a couple of reporters who will push, but they understand full well that if they push too hard, there goes their press pass and probably their career. That's A, or no, that's B. A is the fact that before they're ever hired and put on the, or after they're hired, put on the Washington, the White House beat, their instructions are clear, whether they're implicit or explicit. You will not ask certain questions. You simply will not. And those orders don't come from the White House directly. They come through the corporations that own media. I mean, ultimately, they come from the White House. But they're filtered through the corporations that own media and then to the reporters. And it's a damn shame. It wasn't so long ago that we still had, I'm just my opinion here, but I think the majority of news gatherers, reporters, whether they worked for television or radio or newspapers or magazines, were truly interested in getting at the truth no matter what happened. And there's still some around, but people like Robert Perry or Seymour Hersh, who really push the envelope, do not work for newspapers, do not work for mainstream media. They work for The New Yorker. They work for ConsortiumNews.com. They, it's awful. It's just awful.
It is. It's very disheartening. And I don't understand why those reporters would even want that kind of a job. I mean, it's not what... It's not in the spirit of their profession.
Well, my answer to that is that, starting with Ronald Reagan in this country, mediocrity was raised to an art form. And it doesn't make any difference what area of American culture we're talking about. Look at all of it. Politics, art, music, news reporting. Television, entertainment, mediocrity has been raised to an art form. And we are in, apparently, just my opinion, a sustained period of time now where being mediocre means you survive. It's kind of like whack-a-mole. You know, if you stick your head up a little bit too high, I don't care what you're doing, whether it's, politics or theater or military leadership, if you stick your head up too high, you're going to get whacked. And there goes your career. There goes your. There goes everything.
Do you feel like this is cyclical? That we are going to go back to a period where the Constitution is respected, where the rule of law is evenly, more evenly sort of distributed, or do you feel like this is a slippery slope?
Well, that's the question I have, and I don't have an answer. Connie, I've just got the same question you have, because I wonder sometimes. I mean, I don't know how we get back up this so-called slippery slope. I really don't. Connie, thanks. We're just about out of time. I appreciate you checking in. I hope it is cyclical. I mean, I certainly understand enough of our history to understand that we have peaks and valleys. the only, or not the only, but the major thing I look for is to see whether the artistic community is going to respond. Because it always is the artists and the poets and the writers who start the resistance. I mean, it always is. It really is. It may be an incident, maybe a shoe throwing or a refusal to get up and go back to work in the shipyard factory. But the stage is set for that kind of action by artists, poets, and madmen. That's just the way it's always been. Truly. So we'll see, won't we? We'll see. We'll see if we'll see where the revolutionary force in this country really is. It doesn't have to be guns and bullets. Revolution starts with the artists, doesn't it? You disagree? Anybody disagree? You'll have to wait till tomorrow to answer that. But that's my take on it, anyway. That's it for tonight. Thanks a lot for hanging out. We'll try to come up with enough madness to. Keep a little bit of your attention tomorrow. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.